The Islanders hang in, Brian. I mean, look, they only had 24 shots in, what, 4.5 or so periods of hockey, but it worked out. Barry Trotz's team won't go away.
Yeah, I don't think it's been a Picasso on either side of the league. There's been some low-event games. There's been some great goaltending. The one thing is the hitting's been consistent in both leagues, and I would point that out to some people who are putting teams together that in the playoffs that sometimes matters. And I'm not. That's not a snide remark to the Leafs. I'm talking generally. This is what it turns into at this time of year. And I think the hockey's compelling and interesting. It's just not artistic.
How about the amount? Something else that sticks out to me, Berkey, is the amount of block shots. Are you surprised at that, or just is that just the playoff normal and I'm just seeing things? I feel like guys are having a tough time getting the puck to net, especially in this series.
Yeah, I think both sides of the continent, really, Ziggy, I think now it's collapsing the coverage. It used to be if you watched a television close-up of an attacking, a power play, say, or a good scoring chance on a rebound up close, you might see three of the opposing team in the frame. And then it became four, and now it becomes five guys dropped to home plate. So you'll have the defenseman as low as the goal line, the two forwards between the goal line and the hash mark, and the center just above them. And it's, if you've got three forwards in there and you've got five defenders in there, it's really hard to get the puck through. And the consensus is defend home plate, will give up point shots. A, because our goalie can stop them, and B, because they're lower threat, and C, because they'll probably hit one of these guys anyhow. So it's become a science, getting pucks through and getting them through with any kind of authority. If you can do that, that's a gift. Like Shea Theodore is great at it, but if you can get it through with some authority, that's a gift.
Yeah, because Chris Johnson he tweeted out yesterday, Lightning Islanders have played more than 81 minutes tonight, and the shots on goal are 37-23 Tampa. And I was just, I was shocked at that number. Just you expect more, right? And I mean, analytically, it's tough to really analyze these games and figure out who's playing better. I mean, I don't know who you thought really controlled the playing last night, but I mean, Tampa Bay, I think, has dominated in a lot of areas. I mean, and they don't win. I think the other night, the Vegas dominated the game. Dallas wins. It's like the numbers don't always tell the story.
I love how you asked that, Ziggy. I don't know what you thought, Berkey, but they kind of dominated Tampa Bay last night. It's called leading the witness if you're in a courtroom.
He's a lawyer.
Mr. Burke, wouldn't you say that, for sure, there is no God in hockey, right? There's no justice. Just because you do it right, Vegas did everything right. And when I say their big boys didn't get it done, they clearly didn't, but not for lack of effort. It's just Dallas figured out a way to win those games. I think they're the first team maybe ever to win with a negative goal differential to advance to a Stanley Cup final, and the conference finals to have a negative goal differential. So, like I say, these aren't Picassos, but they're not Peyton Barnes either. There's some good plays. There's lots of hitting. And block shot's kind of a cool play anyway, Ziggy. You were good at it.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a cool play, but it's not as cool as the goal, I'll agree. But I enjoyed the game last night, even though, again, low event, what we call a low event game, low number of scoring chances, low number of huge quality saves, but enough that I thought it was interesting. And the way these guys worked in the first and second overtime, like they've been playing every other day. There's no travel, which is a blessing, but these teams worked last night, and I enjoyed the game. I had people texting me saying this hockey's horrible, and I'm like, I don't know. I didn't mind it.
Mm-hmm.
We're with Brian Burke on Leadoff, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. There's not somebody in the hockey universe, Brian, who hasn't come across Rick Bowness. And I mean, the sense is that everybody just feels good for him. How well do you know Rick, and what do you think of this? I mean, 65 years old, hadn't been a head coach in more than 20 years. It's a great story.
Well, first off, that's not that old. Don't be rude. Don't be obnoxious.
Very young and spry, 65 years old.
You should Google your audience or Google your guests before you get them on.
I'm leading the witness in exactly the wrong way.
When Bones was an assistant coach in Vancouver, and my wife and I were living in Newport Beach, we kept a townhouse in Vancouver, not far from the arena at all. You could walk there. And Bones rented that from us for the one season. And he still owes me $400. He messed up my satellite system. But yeah, I've known him for a long time. Everyone has. It's like I said on radio yesterday, he coached Abraham Lincoln. That's why so many people know him. That's how long he's been around. And so he's worked at it so long, and he's so well-liked and respected. Like, you can't put in that kind of time in the league and not cross paths with literally thousands and thousands of people, players, coaches, owners, GMs, and still be working unless you're a good guy. There's too many guys that could assassinate you along the way there. And that's not a Lincoln pun. I'm just saying there's too many pitfalls unless you're a really good person. So I think the proof is the longevity and the sincerity with which you see people greet him. Like, he'll be walking down the street and some guy will come up to him and say, I played for you 25 years ago. And this happens to me in airports, but with Bones probably daily. And universally liked, universally respected. I don't think there's anyone watching hockey now, even if you are truly a fan of one of the other teams, that doesn't cheer a little bit when they see Rick Bonus advance.
Speaking about coaching, I wanted to ask you about the Capitals hiring Laviolette. Well, your initial reaction, is that who you thought would get the job there?
Yes, I did. Peter Laviolette, I worked with him in Sochi with Team USA. So I have been up close and personal with him. And through the USA program, I've been friends with him much, much longer than that. When I had him in Sochi, first off, he's one of only four coaches to take three different teams to the finals. I'm pretty sure I got that right. Mm-hmm. He has a ring. He's coached numerous teams and made them all better. And again, like I say, three Stanley Cup Finals appearances. But what I watched in Sochi was, first off, he's a commanding presence. He's a big guy. You got to go back to Peter Laviolette. It's a great story. He played at Westfield State College. It's Division III. And for Canadian listeners, there is no Division II in hockey. There's D1 and D3. And the reason that is to be Division II, you've got to hold a national championship. There's all these requirements you have to meet that the hockey teams weren't interested in spending to meet. So back when he played, it was D1, D3. Westfield State. Anyone ever heard of it?
No. Where is it?
It's in Massachusetts.
Okay, Massachusetts. All right.
So he played a handful of NHL games and then had a lengthy, like a Jared Bednar, a lengthy minor league career, like a DJ Smith. These guys go down, learn, and then he starts coaching. Now, unlike those guys, his resume, he wasn't in the minors for a long time. He was such a good coach. He coached 1 year in the ECHL and then was promoted to Providence in the AHL, was there 1 year, 2 years, won coach of the year in the AHL, and was an assistant coach in the NHL. So this guy climbed the ladder way quicker than most of those guys. And he's been in the show now for over 20 years, coaching as a head coach in the NHL. So legit credentials, commanding presence. He's a big guy. He's a handsome guy. He's got a deep voice. You notice him on the bench. If you're a player, you hear him when he talks. But what I liked in Sochi was he had good rapport with the players. He worked at his rapport with the players. He didn't stay in the coach's office. He was out mingling with the players, and I liked his preparation. So, yeah, I think it's a good hire. I think it's a good fit.
Yeah, he's a great guy. I got to play for him in Carolina for a couple of years, and he squeezes everything out of you. Even myself, I at times you think you have nothing left to give, and he'll find a way, or you don't play. And, you know, you appreciate that as a player. The one thing I want to ask you about Washington is, how do you think they came to this decision? Because you have a guy in Trotz, you have a guy that takes you there, does everything right, and you don't want to pay him his extension, but then you bring in another guy for, what is it, almost twice the money. Is that a thing where Washington maybe knew they needed a guy with more experience, or they'd made a mistake?
What I heard out of, Todd Reardon was a finalist when we hired Glenn Gullitson in Calgary, so I got to spend some time with him. He's a good coach. And what I hear out of Washington at the time was, it wasn't about that Todd Reardon didn't get the job done. It just wasn't a good fit, and maybe he wasn't hard enough. Maybe what they needed to get back to the into that race and get back to the top of the mountain was a guy who pushed a little harder. So, but I didn't hear any criticism of Todd's coaching, just maybe his style wasn't demanding enough. And I think they need a guy who can cajole a little bit and befriend players and hug them and put his arm around them in between games and practices. But on the, when they're out there on the ice, you, I think they want a driver. And that's my definition of a good coach, by the way. Everyone talks about we got to be nice to players, and it's a different guy, and it is. It's a different era. But I always, when I hired a coach, I already told him the same thing. I don't want it to be fun during practice. I don't care if the players like it. The fun comes from getting 2 points and having a beer in your stall. That's fun. Getting 2 points, that's fun. You look in the dictionary, open up, it'll say getting 2 points where next to the word fun. So I didn't care if they liked the coach. I didn't care if the coach was fuzzy and happy and went to bought them cookies and milk. I wanted a taskmaster during practice and during the games. Bad language, hard on guys, the whole bit. And then I wanted a positive teaching environment the rest of the time. And the successful coach in the in this era, the millennial coach in this era, straddles that fence. He's hard when he needs to be, but he can be gentle when he has to be. And he makes the players feel welcome. But once they drop the puck, Ziggy, did you expect it to be fun or easy? Or?
No, not at all.
I mean, you think you're going to come off the ice and the coach is going to say, young man, I need you to put a little more effort into tonight's game. You get off. Instead, he's going to say, get your bleeping butt in gear.
Yeah. With Brian Burke. Last one for you, Berkey. And I thought you handled this wonderfully the other night on the air. There is a 17-year-old hockey player in Quebec,
Yannick
Duplessis, who has come out as gay, and he is going to play for the Drummondville Voltigeurs of the QMJHL. And, you know, for me personally, when I first saw this, I welled up, because for me at 17, that would have been 1996. This would have been unimaginable. This is this young man, whether he realizes it or not, he is a hero. And I'm just interested in a thought or two from you on Yannick and his decision to share his truth with the world.
Sure. So I talked to Philippe Boucher, who's the highly respected GM in Drummondville, just to see what the plans were. And I don't think he'll play for Drummondville this year, Yannick.
Okay.
Because they had a quarantine issue for training camp, he hurt his leg, and he had a family matter. So we'll look for this young, he's 17, we'll look for him to play next year. Philippe described him as an energy guy, a great kid, works hard. So this is the first page of a story that hopefully we get to watch for a long time. I think it took great courage. And, you know, my own son came out. It was a non-event in our household, but it was quite a thing. You know, it was a big story nationwide. And I went on national television with him. It is a difficult thing. Well, I talked a little bit about this on TV. When most of the gay people, the LGBTQ people that I've talked to, when you ask them about coming out, what they tell you is the difficulty, even if they're not worried about public perception, the difficulty for most kids is normally a close family member who they think will not accept them as gay. A mom or a dad is number one. An uncle, like their dad's brother who hates gay people, that's, you know, that or a sibling, number two. And so that's the pressure they feel more than outside. If you don't have that pressure, it's much easier. It's what I'm told. Again, not gay. I'm not trying to speak for the gay community, but certainly have been told this by enough people. So his own family, it was a non-event. And it should be a non-event. And so, like, when Brendan came out to us, it was a non-event. It wasn't like, oh, my God, what are we going to do? It's like, okay, Brendan. And I hugged him. I said, you've given us a million reasons to love you. This doesn't change one of them. So that's the attitude we need. Someday this will be a non-event. You know, Scotty, like, it shouldn't be a big event. It shouldn't be news. It should be a non-event, and we'll get there. But it's going to take some time. So good for Yannick Duplessis.